The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
About the practice of retreats. And meditation retreats is one of the cornerstones of our particular movement of Buddhism. And in fact, when we came to the United States in about 1974 or so, we came as a kind of mostly a retreat phenomena. The teachers like Joseph Goldstein and Jack Kornfield, who came from Asia, Sharon Salzberg, they came and started putting on retreats. And the very first retreat in our kind of insight meditation tradition was done in down the Sequoia National Park, California. And I think the second or third one was done, I think, in Boulder Creek. And so Santa Cruz County is in California. It's kind of like where it all began for us in the United States. So we've certainly grown in these 35 years to much more than a retreat tradition. And now we have these community meditation centers like IMC, where hopefully we're developing the practice in a much wider range in our lives than what can happen on retreat. And I would say that in the 70s and 80s, there was a kind of a little bit too much leaning towards the importance of retreats. And we had these retreat junkies, people who go on retreats, and they'd be great yogis, great meditators, and then they go back to their life and fall apart. And then they couldn't wait to get back on retreat. And so after a while, it became clear that we had to develop people's practice. People had to develop their practice and their wisdom and understanding in daily life as well. And so places like IMC have arisen, and a number of places like us around the country. And but for our community, we now have this very strong, I think, community meditation center. But now the pendulum has swung, and we don't have a retreat center, and we're now grown big enough to have one. To have that cornerstone of our of what we offer. There are many different kinds of retreats that our tradition offers. And here in the United States, as we're developing here, we're beginning to offer different kinds of retreats, not just one type. But the classic core kind of retreat we offer are silent retreats, meditation retreats, where there's a schedule for meditation all day long. And since people can't sit all the time, that the schedule alternates between sitting meditation and walking meditation, back and forth. And the retreatants who come spend most of the time in silence. There's usually some time for questions and answers in the meditation hall with the teachers. And there's usually a chance every couple of days to have an interview. We call it interviews, a practice discussion with the teacher about how it's going, checking in. And usually there might be a little bit of talking around the chore that you have. Everyone who comes to the retreat helps put on the retreat. And so you might be doing kitchen prep or washing dishes, and so there's some little discussion that goes on there. But otherwise, it's silent. And some people who never heard of this are shocked to hear that there are people who go and spend I don't know if standard is the right word, but standard length retreat for us is a 10-day retreat. We have some that are 2 days, weekends, 5 days, 10 days, 2 weeks, month, 3 months, you know, various lengths, but 10 days is kind of like the standard. And some people are shocked to learn that people voluntarily don't talk for 10 days. And some people kind of were told that's the deal when they but kind of surprised when they come to the retreat that, wait a minute, I signed up for this? And for some people, it's the first time in their life where they spent an extended period of time not engaged in social conversation. And for some people, it's a shock to do that, the whole shock to their whole system for the first couple of days. And one person told me once she was ready to run out of the center screaming because of it. But by the end of the 10 days, or the end of the 5 days, most people cherish the silence more than anything else. It's one of their favorite parts of the retreat, and they're not ready to give it up. It's quite profound to spend time in silence, because as wonderful it can be to be involved in social conversation, our social conversations are quite complex interpersonally. And there's a lot of psychological dynamics that come into play about our self-image, the image of other, what we need, what we want, what's supposed to happen. And it gets very complicated very quickly. And the mind can very quickly get spinning out, be very actively involved in the concerns around what it means to be involved socially with people. Many of our cultural biases, cultural conditioning comes in play when we're engaged socially with people in conversation. And so if you stop talking for a while, a whole part of our persona, our concerns, our activities, quiet down and get still. And that does two things. It helps us to understand much better than ever before how we are engaged socially, how we're engaged in the world of conversation, the world of commerce, the world of activity out here, in a way that's very hard to see if we stay involved in it. Many years ago, I heard of saying that they have in England, I was told, it's that, where they say, you don't know England unless you leave England. Mm-hmm. And so you don't really some things you can't really understand if you're in the midst of it. You can't understand some aspects of it. And only by stepping outside of it can you really look back and see, oh, that's what was going on. But in the middle of it, I can't see it because supposedly the fish can't see the water they swim in. And so this just a silence, independent of doing meditation, just the fact that people go off and do that is a very profound thing. So one thing is that we get to see ourselves quite well. But the other thing is that because we're not engaged in the usual activities of our ordinary life, we stepped out of that, the usual concerns, activity, movements of the mind and heart settle down and we relax. And one of the great purposes of these retreats is rest, rejuvenation, restoration, kind of recovering from a life that sometimes we need to recover from. And the simplicity and the silence is one of the things that helps provide that. In addition to that, we do the meditation practice. And we do the meditation practice in the context of a very simple life. You get up, usually we wake up at the average maybe is around 5:30, 6. You get up and you have half an hour to get ready for meditation. You do about 45 minutes of meditation. And then someone serves you breakfast. After breakfast, there might be a little work period that you do to help clean up or prepare for lunch. And a little break, and then around 8:30 you go back to do another meditation session. Usually that 8:30 sitting, the teachers are there to give instructions for the day, so you have some guidance for what the practice is. And then the day does not get more complicated after that, except so after that you do walking meditation. After that you have to come back and do sitting meditation, and then you do walking meditation. And then guess what? You get to do sitting meditation again. But then the highlight of the day, the greatest entertainment of the day, is lunch. And you get to eat lunch in silence, and which is really precious to be able to sit. You know, most people do all kinds of other things while they're eating, but to just sit there quietly with your food and enjoy it, take it in, be very settled. Is a really beautiful thing to do. Then you have a break, and then it starts up in the afternoon, sitting meditation, walking meditation, sitting meditation, walking meditation. During that time, you might have a meeting with a teacher to talk about what's going on in your practice. And then in the evening, to keep things simple, we serve a very simple supper. In the past, they used to call it tea, but that frightened people. I'm only supposed to have tea, but actually it's usually soup and crackers and bread or salad, something very simple. So now we call it supper usually. And then after that, there's a little break, and then there's more a meditation session, and then usually in the evening there's a Dharma talk, and then a little walk, and then a little sit, and then at 9:30 people go to sleep. Though a lot of people go to sleep early. It's been a long day, not doing much. And so it's very simple. And that simplicity of kind of is, you know, it's for me, maybe because I'm kind of odd, I associated with the beautiful simplicity and stillness and peace and silence of the stereotypic monastery. Have you ever been to a place that's really peaceful and quiet? Once when I was 18, I was traveling around, bumming around France, and I came to Mont-Saint-Michel, and a beautiful Catholic monastery that you could drive across the plains of northwestern France, kind of flat area, I must remember, and suddenly this kind of place that was probably built by Disneyland, you know, towers up out of the sea. It's a beautiful, you know, it's a big spiraling monastery. And I went there, and they gave a tour of the monastery. And as we walked around the tour, we walked around different places, rooms and stuff, and we came to the original building of the monastery, which was a small stone, with big stone rocks, stone chapel, a one-room chapel. And on that chapel, on top of the hill, they built layers and layers until it became a big monastery. And I walked into the chapel, and this amazing peace and stillness, I don't know, was there or descended there, or if I felt or I became. And it was one of the great, you know, experiences of my teenage years, was to sit there in this room. And that everybody else in the group left, and I stayed behind, because it was just so palpable, it was so rich, it was so meaningful to have this peace and this stillness. It felt so like life was complete and full, and nothing else was needed. And it was became kind of a touchstone for me to that kind of place, that experience. And it wasn't until I started going on Buddhist retreats that I began touching into that level of peace and stillness again. And a lot of it comes from that simplicity. You know, there's not a lot to figure out. Not a lot to do. You don't have to go shopping. You don't have to go cooking your own food. You don't have to answer the phone. And you don't have to answer your BlackBerry. But, you know, we're thinking about, I'm suggesting that we, when we get our retreat center, that they have this technology, like these I don't know what they are, these metal grids or paint with zinc or something, that we need to kind of, I think, in order to preserve this natural resource, national treasure of silence and peace, we need to somehow block the Wi-Fi signals coming in, the cellular signals coming in. Otherwise, we're in trouble. The Spirit Rock teaches a teen retreat every year, and they've commented that the last 2 years, for the first time, they've noticed that the teens coming to retreats are really addicted to their cell phones and their whatever they have. And it's been a real issue now that they just can't get off it, and they're texting. And a friend of my son was texted something like 400 times in 6 hours. He's a 12-year-old. And anyway, I think I think of retreats and retreat centers as being kind of as important as national parks. They are kind of there's a natural, you know, it's a natural resource that is really essential to the human heart, human mind, to be able to go to places where we can do this deep contemplative work, where we can go and do really connect to ourselves in a deep way, settle all the extraneous kind of ways in which we spin out and caught up with ourselves and caught up in life, and settle down and really discover what's here for us here. And it's a profound, beautiful thing. And so, zinc paint, or something, somehow to protect these places to their... So one of the functions of these retreats is to help people rest and recover. Many people need it. They say Americans are a sleep-deprived culture, and people often come to retreats exhausted, and then over the course of the days on the retreat, they often recover. It's quite beautiful to see before and after senses of people on retreat. They look so, people at the end of retreat generally look so fresh and light and like they've lost 10 years in their life. They're younger and more relaxed, and it's quite something. We would probably make a lot of money if we called it a beauty program. Spa. Come and get a facelift. So, yeah, if we run out, if we have trouble financially, we'll do like a couple of weeks a year. We'll put on these very expensive. So, but there's other more profound things that go on. One of the things that go on in retreat is that people catch up with themselves, and there's all this unprocessed material in our lives that we don't have a chance to really see and feel and experience. Because many people keep going and going and going, going to the next thing. They're working, they have kids, there's all this stuff to do that they can't never have a chance to really discover, find out what's really going on. The backlog of emotions, backlog of issues that they haven't really addressed and looked at because they keep going on. And so retreats is a kind of place to stop and let our life catch up to us and find out what's going on. And sometimes it's a surprise. Sometimes there are difficult emotions that are lingering in the background that haven't had the chance. Some people have a backlog of grief. You know, maybe someone they loved died and they couldn't stop to really be present for that for themselves because they're taking care of everybody else. And going on retreat is a time to, finally for me to kind of, or you, to kind of finally let these things catch up and kind of work through it. Or there might be issues, unresolved issues, real issues in life that will bubble up. And sometimes it's been surprising to people what's an unresolved issue. And the heart knows, whereas sometimes you don't. And so sometimes it could be something that's 20, 30 years old that really needs to be addressed. And something kind of bubbles up in the context of the stillness, the silence, simplicity. Oh, that's not resolved. I better go talk to that person and kind of continue the conversation. So our life has a chance to catch up to us. It's a profound thing. Another thing is that we start seeing, the primary function of these retreats is a chance for us to engage in the meditation practice in a complete, thoroughgoing way. It's a way of developing the skill of meditation. It's the way of developing our capacity, where we're uninterrupted. And so in daily life, you're lucky if you get to sit for 40 minutes at home, perhaps. But to be able to do it all day long, we get to kind of develop the skill of meditation. We get to learn ourselves, who we are in the context of meditation, and learn to work through some of the challenges we have in meditation. We get to develop some of the beautiful aspects of meditation, the concentration, the stillness, in a fuller, more complete way than we can in regular life. And so it's one of the great ways of learning meditation is to be on retreat. And so it's a way of developing deep concentration, deep mindfulness. People can develop tremendous experiences of love, loving kindness, by doing it nonstop, doing it all day long. And for some people find that they go on retreats to jumpstart their practice. Their practice hasn't really taken off in daily life, but they go on retreat, and it gives a real boost. So when they come back, they're motivated and they're into it. Another function of retreats is not so much to take care of backlog of things, but rather to discover the operating principles that we live on and the conditionings that we operate on, the belief systems, the emotions, the reactions, the tendencies we have. And most people don't really understand themselves that well. And it's a little mystery why people do what they do. And it can be going on retreat, being still and silent and simple that way, and cultivating mindfulness, paying careful attention. Pretty soon you start noticing what drives you, what really motivates you. And sometimes it's quite beautiful, what people discover, and sometimes it's quite shocking. to realize. It's not uncommon for someone, probably at every retreat I teach, someone comes to me after 5 or 6 days, and they'll say, I had no idea how pervasive fear was in my life. I'm anxious all the time, and it's the background of everything I do and think, but I didn't know it until I stopped and looked. And so it's really good news to see it, because then you can do something about it. You can start becoming free of it. And sometimes, it might be aversion that's always it, or feeling insecure, or feeling, there's all kinds of underlying kind of operating systems that are difficult to see in ordinary life that slowly over time get revealed when you go on retreat. And that process of becoming free, which is the point of Buddhism, is to become learn how to be free of these underlying unhealthy operating systems that we might have. And that's the good news, is that we can do that. It's possible to do it. We don't have to be stuck in one particular way. There is another side that we can get to if we see it and very honest. It's really wonderful to do this practice, to develop the meditation practice on retreat, because of you have community support. And it's quite something to be together with a group of other people doing the same thing. I think of meditation retreats as a teacher now for many years. My experience is that on retreat, the best in people come forth. And it's really something to be together with a group of people where the very best of what people who they are is what is coming out. And the reason the best is coming out is because people are trying to be honest. People are trying to not be pushed around by the normal reactivities, the normal operating systems, normal reactions to how things are. In daily life, you might get pushed around quite a bit by your reactions. Daily life, you go on the freeway and someone cuts you off, and automatically you do something with one of your fingers. I don't know which one. But on retreat, you feel, if someone cuts you off on the lunch line or something. You're somewhat quiet, you're mindful, and you say, I don't want to be pushed around by an urge to do something with my finger. I mean, I'm trapped then. I'm a slave to something, to a habit, to reaction, to reactivity. I would like to be free. I'd like to not be pushed around by someone's reactions to me and my feelings in return. Let me see and discover what it's like to be free of response, of reacting habitually. And so that very motivation to be free tends to, people don't give in to what's not the best in them. They tends to give birth to what's best in people. It's beautiful. And occasionally there are people who come to me and say, Gil, you don't know how bad I really am. because I see the best in people there, but I know that we're all mixed bags, and I know how hard it is and what we're struggling with. So retreats have a lot of functions, but then what is a retreat? For some people, it's retreating from their life. The historian Toynbee talked about the importance of a cycle of withdrawals and return, that people really need to withdraw from their normal life for a while and then return. And he pointed out that some of the great religious leaders of humanity followed that cycle of withdrawal and then return, the 40 days in the desert. Vision quests in Native Americans. For us Buddhists, we have what we call in the West, called retreats. In Zen, where they have sesshins, the Japanese word, the word sesshin means to unify the mind or unify the heart. And I like that instead of retreat, because some people feel like you're giving up retreat. They're retreating, white flag. but I like the word, it's to treat again. It's a wonderful treat. I love retreats. It's just a treat. But what are retreats? And the other thing that it's clear to me is that there are many, at any given retreat, there are as many retreats going on as there are people. And it's amazing, you know, to be a teacher on retreat. And, you know, I'll usually the meeting with the teachers are 15 minutes long, and I might have a series of them in a row, like six in a row or something. And it's like a different retreat comes in every person. They're all having different experiences and different ways of being with it, even though they share so much of this in common. So I'll give you a little example. When I was at Tassajara, which is a Zen monastery, and there were about, you know, when I was there, I think there were somewhere about, maybe around 50 people living in the monastery. And one year, there were two new students who came to join the monastery at the same time. They didn't know each other, so they came at the same time. And after about 3 months, I had conversations with each of them separately, and they told me about what it was like for them to be at the monastery. And they were the same place, living kind of in the same situations, same schedule, same group of people, everything. The guy said, "I've lived for the last 20 years in a house by myself in Daly City and been single. And I came here to Tassajara, and it's oppressive to me. There's all these people. There's people everywhere. I'm never free of people. And this is really hard, and I have to come to terms with this." That was his task. That was his work. Not to retreat back to his house in Daly City, but to really try to understand what was going on for him and his reactions, responses, and learn to have some kind of peace, liberation, in the context of people. The woman who came down said, "I grew up with a very large family, lots of kids, lots of brothers and sisters. When I was 18, I got married, left home to get married, and had kids, and had a number of kids myself. And I've always been around people. And now I'm here at Tassajara, and finally I'm alone. I can't believe my good luck." You know, so they brought their background and their conditioning with them, and how their experience of the retreat was affected by what they needed to address and what, you know, was needed. And so people come with a lot of different backgrounds, a lot of different needs, a lot of different agendas, a lot of different approaches. And so people have different, you know, different experiences on the retreat. The people who are, what is challenging for one person is helpful and beneficial for the other. What is beneficial for one person is challenging for another person. But the fact that it's challenging doesn't mean that it's wrong. It means that this is really useful for people to address, to look at, to work with. And different people have different things they have to work through and address. Some retreats, it's all about addressing and working through something difficult and challenging. Some retreats, it's all about appreciating the benefits and joys of retreats, of getting concentrated and deep. Sometimes, after a really beautiful opening, deep practice and meditation, it sets the stage for now having the confidence or the willingness to look at some of the more difficult aspects of a person's life. And the next retreat might be quite difficult. Some people have a really difficult retreat, and that sets the stage for a future retreat where it's a whole different, the beauty in their heart begins to shine forth in a way that's unparalleled in their life. And the degree of peace and love they can experience is just so beautiful. We say that each person gets the retreat they need to have. And maybe it's a superstitious statement, but it's basically true, because the real thing that's going on in the retreat, the real thing that's happening there, the real retreat is you. And when you go on retreat, you bring yourself. And that's really what's going on. And the retreats is this this amazingly powerful, useful, supportive, nurturing environment in which to meet yourself, to see yourself in a profound and honest way. And in doing that, to be able to move through, free up what needs to be moved through, free up what needs to be freed up, and discover the hidden treasures that we all have in our hearts and minds. And then, once we've withdrawn, retreated, then we return to our life. And it's my hope and my dedication that we are offering retreats, we're offering this practice and this teaching so that we can bring back the benefits to this wider world that we live in. It's not something we do just to be peaceful ourselves, but we bring back this to bring peace and love and freedom and honesty and truthfulness to the world that we live in as well. It's very important, I feel. So if you've never been on a retreat, I would suggest one for you. You might start with a day and then work up to a weekend or 5 days. Some people are the jumping in with their feet first person, and so they 10 days they just do right away. I've heard of people who did the 3-month retreat at IMS who had never meditated before, just went off. And some people do quite a bit longer retreats. I did an 8-month retreat, 8 months of silence. It was, among the top, I don't know what, 5 most important and joyful and loving experiences of my life was to go on that 8-month retreat. So, and it's become a touchstone for me. The experiences I've had on retreat are a touchstone for me that I carry with me. And who I am as a teacher, who I am as a person, has very much been shaped by the stillness, the peace, the self-confrontation, the challenges I've had on retreat. I'm very happy to talk about it, happy to share about it, and very happy in a few minutes to be able to tell some of you about hopefully what will become IMC's Insight Retreat Center. So, thank you all.